Hello everyone, welcome to Travels Through Time, the podcast made in partnership with Dynamic Room, the visual historians who bring the past back to life. Hello, I'm Peter Moore. Today we're joining one of the most epic, exhilarating, and little known events of the Middle Ages. That's the pilgrimage of Mansa Musa to Mecca. Most of you listeners will know that Jeff Bezos, the CEO and founder of Amazon, is the richest man alive today. He's estimated to be worth something like $166 billion. As unimaginable as that amount of money may seem to us today, he cannot think himself as wealthy, and this is in comparative terms, as Mansa Musa, who was the 14th century emperor of Mali. We know that these comparisons are fraught, but if Mansa Musa's riches were translated into 21st century terms, some estimated that he would be worth around $400 billion. But it's reductive to think of Mansa Musa solely in terms of money. His reign was as rich culturally as it was materially. And its most decadent moment came with his pilgrimage to Mecca. We have a superb young historian to guide us back to that event today. Luke Papera is a writer and a storyteller who seeks to explore and reveal the history, mythology, and culture of Africa. He's a graduate of the University of Oxford, where he studied archaeology and anthropology. A few days ago, Luke sat down with another brilliant young historian, our very own Artemis Irvine. I hope you enjoy their conversation.
Thank you so much for joining us on Travels Through Time, Luke.
Thank you for having me.
I thought we could start by just you telling us a bit about what first drew you to this particular subject.
When I was 16, I was in Ghana, and obviously I had taken, or was looking to take actually, my A-level history course. You were doing sort of the typical things, you know, Tudors, we did a bit of Russian Revolution. I know these were the things that I was going to be studying. But while I was in Ghana, I'd been doing some reading of my own about certain aspects of Ghanaian history or Ghanaian culture, and really only encountered a lot of the more contemporary colonial stuff. I went actually to the museum in Ghana, the National Museum, because I wanted to find out a bit more about the deeper history and the deeper culture of Ghana. And all the artifacts there, at least in the National Museum, were to do with the colonial period. There were coins, there were guns, and those kinds of things. And I asked myself at the time, well, you know, is there something more? Is there something deeper? So I got in touch actually with as a historian at the University of Ghana, and she was an expert on sort of, you know, the deeper culture, especially of the Ashanti tribe, the tribe of which, you know, I'm a member. So I went to a lecture that she gave at the University of Ghana, and she was talking about, rites of kingship and all these very, very exciting things which I had encountered. And she actually recommended, you know, that I read certain articles. So suddenly I started gleaning information, the history of Ghana, not, you know, the 18th, 19th, 20th centuries, you know, which emphasized or where Ghana changed because of this European contact, but things stretching back to the 12th century, you know, the kingdom of Bonoman, which was actually sort of one of the founding empires of what is today, you know, Ghana, one of the first ones that the Akan people of Ghana founded. And then through that, I was learning about sort of the different empires, especially with the medieval period, which is sort of it's a golden age, really, for African societies and African culture and African art and architecture. And then at university, when I was applying for university, I saw that in the archaeology and anthropology course, there was a section on sub-Saharan African states and their formation. And reading through that, I realized I'd find out about, you know, things like Great Zimbabwe, sort of Southern Africa, and, you know, the empires of Mali and, you know, Ghana and Songhai and all these, you know, very, very exciting things, stuff which I never encountered. And I don't think, you know, a lot of people know about anyway. And I decided that that was going to be my focus, and to bring that to the mainstream a tiny bit more was going to be my ambition. So it sort of started at 16, and then as I went to university, was learning more and more about all these very exciting things, and you know, even a lot of the stuff that's in the British Museum but people don't know about, like the Ife heads, and I mean the bedded bronzes, people know about how they were taken and brought to the British Museum. A lot of people don't know about, you know, their origins and, you know, why they were created and what, you know, what were they for and all this type of stuff. So a lot of African history had been characterized by European contact and the European perspective. Trevor Roper famously says, you know, all African is known as the Dark Continent, and then sort of suggests that Africa, you know, has no history, and there's this idea of Africa having no history before European contact, but which is why when I discovered it, it was a treasure trove of knowledge and you know, very exciting information.
Yeah, no, that's a really cool story. I love that. I mean, I was quite interested to ask you a bit about studying anthropology, because I think it has a bit of a reputation for being, in the past, quite a, almost a racist discipline, studying people of colour, like their kind of subjects to be analysed. Is that something that you thought about when you were studying it?
Yes, I mean, anthropology, absolutely right in saying, is essentially, it was a discipline only really created because of colonialism or colonization, essentially. But what's also more important is that you have racist ideologies which have disseminated through Europe in particular, and Britain in particular, because of the propaganda, the racist propaganda of the pro-slave slavery lobby. They wanted to make sure that slavery remained, you know, a viable financial institution for as long as possible. So they had to present Africans as being naturally inferior and naturally subordinate, which justified their owning of slaves, and which also was used later to justify the colonization of different lands. But usually when countries or states are invading others, you know, they have to think to themselves, you know, why can I, a human being with similarities with these other people, you know, why can I suddenly, you know, go somewhere and treat them as if they're not, you know, the same, you know, the same as me, you know, as human beings? The only real reason, or the main reason Africans are being used by slaves in the first place, is because they're more resistant to the diseases in, you know, in the so-called New World. And a lot of the native population has died because of the activities of the conquistadors and, you know, the introduction of different illnesses. But for me, doing anthropology specifically, one of the important things is that Africa, the way we record our history is not written, really. Oral histories are important. Archaeology is important, or material culture is important. So you study that as a discipline, your emphasis is on the written historical record. It's on diaries. It's on, you know, it's on diaries. It's on slabs. It's on, you know, that kind of stuff. It's all the written word. And this is why, for a long time, Africa hasn't been, you know, African history hasn't been mainstream, because history is, you know, an academic discipline which is defined by the study of written historical records. That makes it, by its, you know, by sort of unfortunate definition, quite Eurocentric, because, you know, from the Anglo-Saxon period going onwards, history in, you know, Europe, and, you know, especially the medieval era, etc., is written, starts to be written. There are lots of written records. Writing history is important, and there's this also strange kind of belief of written history being a lot more credible than oral history. And of course, oral histories over time change, and actually that's sometimes the purpose of them being oral, is that they're malleable. So if you want to, you know, stake your claim over you know, something, you know, sort of the oral history, you can sort of change that to make it though, you know, your ancestors arrived there first, you know, which gives you a greater claim. Written history can also be lies. It's just that they're codified. It's just that they're written down. So it's not necessary, just because someone writes that their army was, you know, 100,000 and their enemy's army was only 10,000, it doesn't mean that it's true. But that's why I chose anthropology in terms of study, because I knew that you have to understand, you know, these other aspects that are emphasized in anthropology: oral histories, you know, songs, dances, stories, that you don't really come into, you know, as much contact with if you're doing history. So to understand African history in particular, I knew that I had to come at it from a different angle. And the same applies to writing it, and to to documenting it, to writing it.
Yeah, and it's interesting, because there are so many when you're talking about songs and dances and stories and material culture, it's there are so many, even in within the context of European history, you can get so much more from looking at those kind of sources and putting the written sources to one side for a second. Like, I did loads of women's history at university, and the fact is that women just weren't writing as much as men were, so you do have to like look a bit beyond or be kind of imaginative with the materials that you have, because it's not as straightforward as like Samuel Pepys's diary, where he just lays it all out. Exactly. And you know, that kind of thing.
Exactly. I mean, another problem, well, I say another problem, I guess it's not as serious as that per se, but another issue with the written history is that, sort of compared to the oral histories, is also, I mean, history as a discipline is defined in the way that especially European cultures remember history. You know, in Ghana or in Europe, if I begin with Europe, it's about, you know, history is about recording and accurate accounts of the past. Mm-hmm. If I'm not correct, it's about recording facts so that you can have this kind of understanding of what actually happened. And, you know, what is written is assumed to, you know, be what actually happened. You know, when you're reading a contemporary history book, you're not saying that, you know, this is how we remember it. This is, you know, you're saying, you know, this is what happened at this time and this is why it's important, etc. For Africans' history, etc. But a lot of the questions we're having to ask ourselves today about, you know, how I remember, etc., is because, you know, our identities, you know, the way we've, you know, looked at our histories, because there are facts, like some of the horrible things that happened, you know, under colonialism, etc. And then there's identities, you know, seeing yourselves as British. A lot of British people might see themselves, I don't know about the case, but might see themselves, let's say, as, you know, the vanguards of, you know, democracy and liberalism when they were threatened by the Nazi threat. You know, that kind of, you know, that's a truth in the way that they see themselves. Whether that's actually a fact, because of, let's say, the influence or the, you know, the help that, you know, Russia, for example, who lost a huge amount of soldiers defending the Eastern Front, or the USA, for example. This is a real sort of, this is a really sophisticated understanding of the purpose of history. And I think Africans tend to have this very sophisticated understanding about history, that it's more about, you know, identity and how it makes you feel, etc., because it's, you know, quite an ancient, probably actually it's the most ancient culture by definition, the most ancient civilization, where history is important. And it's important everywhere. It's just that we embrace that, whereas a lot of other countries try and have this idea of the factual past and the way they remember the past, and trying to have these two, believing that these two things are the same when they're not. What actually happened is very different from the way we, you know, the way we remember things and how we feel about things.
Taking all of that conversation that we've just had about using our imaginations and memory and that kind of thing, I think it's maybe time for us to travel back in time. If you could travel back in time, what year would you visit?
Well, I would visit the year 1325, and in particular, I'd visit the Empire of Mali, which at this time is in its, you know, it's reached its peak. It's a real golden age, not only for Africa in terms of trade and scholarship and all kinds of aspects, but Mali especially is one of the more successful and more powerful and more interesting, I guess, of the empires. And Mansa Musa, its emperor at this time, is certainly one of the most impressive monarchs in sort of African history, and also interesting, he's very, what I like about him is that he's smart, but he's also very diplomatic and he's very understanding. And this is actually how he manages to build an effective, important, flourishing empires, actually through sort of, you know, diplomacy and humility and that kind of stuff, as opposed to war and conquest. So I think that maybe can also teach us interesting lessons for, you know, today and for the future as well.
Definitely. So it's early 1325, and we're with Mansa Musa as he's just embarked on a pilgrimage to Mecca. And could you tell us a bit about what that would look like? What, you know, where would he be and what would he be traveling with and that kind of thing?
Yes, well, I mean, it's usually when you're sort of digging into the details, almost mind-boggling to sort of, you know, realize or understand actually the scale of this pilgrimage. So story goes that Mansa Musa actually sets off on this pilgrimage because he accidentally kills his mother. Now, we don't actually know the details of how this happened. You know, I think it might have been because of an archery incident. You know, the bow and arrow were seen to be symbols of kingship. So he accidentally kills his mother, and then he goes to one of the, you know, Muslim guardians and teachers of sort of religious knowledge, and he asks this teacher, you know, what can I do to redeem myself? Now, Mansa Musa is described as being quite a, you know, well, very, 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 very pious. And actually, he's actually the emperor who makes Islam the definitive and official religion of the Malian Empire. And he does this basically to try and unite the empire, because when he comes to the throne, it's this, you know, it's very, very disparate. There are lots of different groups of people who believe in all sorts of different things, and especially animist and localized, you know, religious beliefs are still heavily emphasized, especially in the non-urban areas. So Mansa Musa thinks to himself, how can I unite this, you know, large kingdom under, you know, sort of one banner, one identity? And he turns to Islam. So he makes it the official religion, but he knows that people in the city are keen to, although people in the city are keen to convert, especially because in the city there are a lot of merchants and there are a lot of traders who know that, you know, having a Muslim identity is really important for connecting you, especially to the trade networks that, you know, and goods that are coming from the Arab world in particular and North Africa. You know, being basically, it opens a lot of doors being Muslim, because, you know, at this time it's you know, getting into the golden age of Islam. You know, Islamic scholars and Islamic are some of the best in the world. Islamic traders are some of, you know, you know, the most effective and you know, the wealthiest in the world, etc. So he unites everybody again, you know, sort of under this banner of Islam, although he's careful not to disrupt, especially those in the non-urban areas who have access to the gold mines, etc. So he actually also, he's not fanatical. You know, he doesn't outlaw other religions. He doesn't launch any, you know, religious wars or wars in the name of Allah. Mansa Musa, you know, to me is I really 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 like, because he's, you know, he's very diplomatic, and this is actually how he manages to make the Mali Empire great, is because of his negotiation and diplomatic skills, yeah. Not only with the different groups in his kingdom, but also with different countries, as we can see, or we'll see later on. So he has, and he kills his mother. This religious leader tells him that he has to seek refuge with the Prophet of God and place himself under you know, Muhammad's protection, etc. Essentially, and he interprets this, essentially you have to make a pilgrimage to Mecca. You have to do the Hajj. It's a huge, like, national affair, which is why I think it'd be very, very exciting to be here. The journey itself, I reckon, must have been quite interesting. I mean, we're told, and this might actually be another another one of these exaggerations, a lot of this comes from not only Mali oral history, but also from Arabic travelers who, you know, recorded accounts, albeit slightly later, of what this pilgrimage was, because it's actually interesting, one of the biggest events of the 14th century. Puts Africa, or it puts actually Mali, but Africa more particularly, on the map, you know, both figuratively and literally, you know, the map that's made in 1375 by Abraham Kresge. It actually launches, you know, the age of exploration in a lot of ways. This is when Europeans are starting, okay, there's money to be made further afield. So they start trying to make inroads in Africa. And obviously we know sort of the historical, you know, what happens afterwards, you know, when they reach Africa and then when they reach the New World. And then, you know, those two, you know, big events, you know, sort of form the foundation of you know, of the slave trade and of, you know, and later of the colonization of Africa. And it's interesting that it starts with this one event, you know, this one huge event. But Mansa Musa embarks on this because, you know, for that purpose, he's actually trying to raise the prestige of Mali. And he takes his wife as well, Inari Conte, and her 500 serving ladies. And every Friday, it is said, when he, you know, during the journey, every Friday he stops and he orders a mosque to be built. Mansa Musa is apparently also a very good husband, because not only does he build the mosque, but his wife, Inari Conte, and I think as not only as a Muslim, but as an emperor, he has more than one wife. But, you know, his first wife, Inari Conte, says that she misses, you know, the waters of Niger River, and that she wants to take a bath. So he tells Faba, his chief of servant, Mansa Musa tells Faba that, you know, the story and about his, you know, his wife wanted to take a bath. And Faba immediately orders, you know, all the servants, as many servants as he can, to dig a huge hole, you know, and fill it with water, etc. And they finish it, you know, again, it is said that they finish it, you know, by the next day, so that she and her serving ladies can, you know, can take this bath. And another one of his wives also expresses, you know, desire to take a bath. So he orders an irrigation system to be built, like in the middle of the desert, you know, dozens of meters of trenches, etc., to fill, you know, to fill her bathtub. And actually, the treatment of women in Mali is also, you know, sort of quite fascinating. It's interesting to mention, is actually, especially for, and this, you know, probably points to Mansa Musa's sort of general lack of Islamic fanaticism. But the Arab travelers, Ibn Battuta, for example, is one, although he comes slightly later, but he complains that in Mali, you know, the women and the servant women or the slave women, but also Mansa meaning emperor, you know, the Mansa's children, like daughters, go about naked and, you know, are way too, you know, liberal and essentially too relaxed and having too much fun, which I find quite funny. Matriarchy is important, matrilineal is important, inheritance flowing through the female lines. Mansa Musa, during his reign, expands the empire, you know, to include 24 more cities and towns. But then again, also the procession is said to be quite long as well. I mean, and it says that when the head of the procession is in Timbuktu, you know, he's still in Niani's capital. Wow. And that's a distance of like 1,000, you know, kilometers or something.
Just before we kind of join them in Cairo, for your second scene, I just wanted to ask a bit about, I was reading in preparation for this interview that a lot of the gold that we find in European medieval paintings and the gold that belonged to European royalty came from Mali. I just wanted to ask you a bit about if that was true.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, over 50% at this time in the medieval era, over 50% of actually, you know, the world's gold that's circulating around is, you know, originates from Mali. It's supplying over 50% of the world's gold. But gold is important. Salt as well. Kola nuts are also important. But and then this is interesting as well, because we think of globalization as being, again, this quite sort of modern phenomenon. But these in the medieval period, and especially the early modern period, are definitely, like, you know, they're definitely global. But yeah, no, that's absolutely true. So a lot of the gold detail in medieval paintings, etc., has originated, you know, its origin is from Mali. But, you know, gold from Mali was going, as you know, as far as you know, India and sort of, you know, perhaps even to China, and so it ends up all over the place.
I think people do think that medieval people were quite like still, like they just stayed in their own place. I think I was reading as well that Ibn Battuta, who you mentioned earlier, he was incredibly well traveled, wasn't he? He went all over the world and even went to Russia and things, which just feels like you just don't pair those things, those different places together in this period. But of course they were all connected, just as they are today.
Definitely.
Hi, I'm Artemis. At Travels Through Time, we're incredibly proud to be partnering with Jordan Lloyd, one of the world's leading visual historians. His extraordinary photo colorization work has appeared on the covers of National Geographic, Life, and People magazines, and he's worked on special projects for titles like The Times of London and NPR. The quality of his work really has to be seen to be believed. Portraits of Charles Darwin and Abraham Lincoln, and sweeping panoramas of the D-Day beaches in June 1944. Just to name a few. One of our favourites is a colourised shot of RMS Titanic as she cuts loose from her moorings in Southampton in 1912 to begin her fateful voyage. It's a picture full of narrative power. These images are now available as beautiful prints, and they make an unusual and striking present for that friend or family member of yours who loves the past. To find your favourite historical image, have a look at Jordan's site at www.colorgraph.co. And that's colour spelt the American way, C-O-L-O-R, colorgraph.co. That leads us on, I think, quite nicely to your second scene, rather, that you would like to visit, because it's religion and Islam that allows Mansa Musa and the Egyptian Sultan to overcome some maybe initial differences, if you'd like to tell us a bit about that.
Yes. So, I mean, this would be my second scene. Mansa Musa is, you know, he's done this pilgrimage, in large part not only to atone for, you know, the sin of accidentally killing his mother, not only in honor of his mother, but he sees it also as an opportunity to increase the reputation, or to spread the reputation and improve the prestige of Mali. So he goes to when he ends up in in Egypt. He knows that part of the Mamluk is the Mamluk Sultan there, Al-Nazir Muhammad, and he knows that he's going to have to, if he sees him, if he has an audience with him, he's going to have to bow down, you know, before him. And Mansa Musa doesn't want to bow down before him. And Al-Nazir Muhammad doesn't want to bow down before Mansa Musa because, you know, he doesn't want to give this impression, especially of weakness and of kind of, you know, subordinating himself to a foreign ruler. So he's not keen then to kind of immediately bow to Mansa Musa and demonstrate any kind of weakness. But this is where Mansa Musa is again very, very, you know, very, very smart, is that when he gets to Egypt, and he's invited in. Initially, he's camping outside, sort of near the pyramids, and he's invited in. And one of the emirs of Egypt says, you know, you have to, if you, you know, you've come to this town. Al-Nazir Muhammad actually invites him in because he's wondering what all the hubbub is about. You know, a lot of people are talking about, you know, this huge amount of wealth, and, you know, people who are just outside Egypt, you know, just outside the capital city, you know, what's going on. And so he invites Mansa Musa in, and the emir says, you know, okay, before you see him, just know that you're going to have to, you know, bow down and kiss the ground before, you know, kiss his hand and kiss the ground before his feet, etc. And Mansa Musa is not keen to do this. So again, this shows his diplomacy. He actually doesn't say outright and, you know, talk about how wealthy he is, etc. He actually just emphasizes that he's there on a pilgrimage. He says, you know, no, I don't really want to come in, you know, I'm here for holy reasons, you know, I don't want to see him. No, it's fine, like, I respect him, I just don't want to see him. Abu Persis, he says, no, you know, you have to, honestly, he's probably like, it'll be my head if you don't, so he had to come in. Yeah, please, he's like, please come in. So Mansa Musa, okay, so he eventually relents and he goes inside. And there's almost this sort of standoff, you imagine, between Al-Nazir Al-Nazir Muhammad and Mansa Musa, and it's kind of like, you know, a game of chicken, like, who's going to go first? And what Mansa Musa does, you know, which is very smart, is that he kisses the ground, but he does it in the name of Allah. He does it in the name of God. He doesn't do it about Al-Nazir Muhammad specifically. And what he's emphasizing there is that there's a greater power than both of them, and this is actually enough to gain the, you know, the respect and, you know, the acceptance of Al-Nazir Muhammad. Al-Nazir Muhammad, so he goes to Al-Nazir Muhammad, and actually apparently they talk quite enthusiastically, and then once he leaves, Al-Nazir Muhammad actually gives him, you know, horses and armor. Al-Nazir Muhammad is very, very pious as well. Him and Mansa Musa should actually get on really, really well. You know, Al-Nazir, he builds the Al-Nazir Muhammad Mosque in Cairo, which I think actually still stands, and he's building canals and all that type of stuff. You know, and the mosque is absolutely beautiful, and he's obviously doing a lot of things to raise the prestige of Egypt, and I think Mansa Musa sees this common ground. Then that leads to a strengthening of relations between Egypt and between Mali, which come very much in handy later on.
Yeah, it sounds like an amazing piece of political theatre. I can really see them both there, and Mansa Musa's entourage all behind him, and how potentially threatening that might have felt to have somebody like that arrive in a place where you're meant to be top dog.
Exactly, especially given your, you know, your history, you know, your part. You know, people have tried to use, if I show weakness, then other people might try to unseat me again. So there's that kind of insecurity perhaps on Al-Nazir Muhammad's side. You know, especially coming face to face, like you say, you know, with this sort of, you know, seem very impressive Sultan, Mansa Musa.
We spoke a tiny bit about sources at the beginning, but I just was really interested to ask you about it again for this particular scene, because it's such a vivid story. And like you say, you can really imagine being there and listening, seeing the advisor whispering in his ear and that kind of thing. Like, where do we get these? What are the sources for stories like these?
So the main written sources, obviously there's the oral sources. The main written sources are the Arabic travelers. You have Al-Umahri, who actually recounts that specific story about the emir. He actually speaks to the emir, and it's the emir Abu, the emir who convinced Mansa Musa to see Al-Nazir Muhammad, who's actually telling the stories. This is how it happened. So Al-Umahri is important. Ibn Battuta is important. Al-Makrizi, who's a contemporary Egyptian historian, is important. He records how, Mansa Musa's visit through Cairo, and he records how his entourage, you know, spent, you know, lavishly, and, you know, and, you know, were buying all sorts of things from the Egyptian merchants, etc. So he's important. So those are really the two main sources. There's oral histories, and then, because in Malian society at this time, and actually they still exist, you have the griot, Some of who, you know, I talked about a bit when I did my, you know, my Twitter threads. But you have the Greer, who are kind of these keepers of the stories, and they're charged not only with, and you know, they're an official role, and they're an important role as well. And so they keep and recount, you know, stories of ancestors and you know, historical events, etc.
Are they a bit like the equivalent of a bard in
exactly
Greece?
Exactly, they
like
are.
Homer
they are
or the something like that.
That's exactly right. They are the absolute equivalent of the bard. You know, they are all sort of Homer-like figures, which is why you have, I mean, it's interesting that, you know, in the Odyssey and the Iliad, which is, you know, two of my favorite, you know, I love both of them, I'm a big fan of Homer and especially, you know, Greek, you know, mythology, but yes, they're exactly like Homer. So even in their stories, there's kind of a mix between, you know, there's a mix between truth and legend. You know, there's the mortal and there's the divine. You know, there's
just on kingship, I wanted to pick up on something you were saying. Was there a sense that these monarchs were seen as divine? Because I know in Europe at the time there is a kind of sense of that.
That's really, really good question, because actually Sundiata, you know, who is the founder, and I think he's actually Mansa Musa's, he's either his granduncle or his grandfather, I'm not exactly sure, people say both, but Sundiata Keita, who's known for founding the Malian Empire, certainly has a mythical status. Like he's born, you know, but this is the story told by the griots, you know, the storytellers, the oral historians. You know, he's born lame, and he's, you know, he's dispatched from his kingdom by a jealous half-brother, him and his mother, when his father dies. And, you know, he's sort of taking under the charge of, you know, a different king. And he just magically overcomes his disability. What's interesting about Mansa Musa in particular is that there doesn't seem to be a lot of that, you know, mythical status about him. The gold miners, interesting enough, are accorded this kind of mythical status. Mansa Musa himself isn't. I mean, he even, you know, Mansa Musa, when, and I think this is actually on his return from Mecca, but he basically, you know, during his reign, he institutes essentially, you know, a legal code which affords rights to the people in his kingdom, the citizens of his kingdom. Because in the medieval era, of course, the king is absolute, you know, he's divinely, you know, he's part diviner, you know, he rules with the divine right of kings. And it is you can't challenge that, you know, his rule, him being there, is not just, you know, his will, it's the will of a higher power. So therefore he's, you know, there's this hierarchy between him, you know, being part divine, and, you know, the other people and the nobles and the other people in his kingdom, etc. Now, what Mansa Musa does by instituting this legal code which affords rights to his people is basically saying that actually, you know, he can be challenged on certain things. He can't actually just rule in any way he likes, you know, as a tyrant. He is actually held to account, you know, by this code of practice. And I think having that, and also I think another thing is Islam as well, and perhaps even that being mixed as this kind of syncretism with the local traditions. I mean, that idea of that, I mean, everybody, again, it's this idea of everybody being equal, you know, in the eyes of Allah. And if there are sort of important human intercessors between, you know, or intercessors between Allah and the, you know, and the human world, these are people like, you know, the Sharifs, these are, you know, scholars, you know, etc. These are, you know, or descendants or relations of, you know, the Prophet Muhammad. You know, it's him who has. So there's that. So that's sort of the way the hierarchy pans out. So there's probably this feeling, especially in Islamic, you know, in Islam, of, you know, there being, you know, a great God, and everybody below him sort of being, you know, more or less a bit more equal.
What is the third scene that you'd like to visit, Luke?
So the third scene I'd like to visit would be the later part of the construction of the Djingarebe Mosque. This is just after Mansa Musa has returned from Mecca with a whole bunch of Islamic architects and poets and philosophers and mathematicians, and he hears that Timbuktu has been conquered by his general Sagamandia, who he put in charge of his kingdom while he was away. And he orders one of these poet architects, Al-Sahili, he pays him the equivalent of £1.5 million to build this Djingarebe Mosque, which soon becomes one of the centres of scholarship at the what we would could term as the University of Timbuktu. With the building of the Djingarebe Mosque, he has come back. But what is important is that on his way back from Mecca, Obviously, he'd gone there not only to raise the prestige of the kingdom, but he also wanted to, he knew that, you know, Islam had some of the world's finest, you know, thinkers and scholars and diplomats and, you know, lawyers, etc. So when he goes to Mecca, he's also concerned, actually, with bringing back to Mali some of these individuals in order to help improve, you know, the Malian kingdom and Malian society. And obviously, and that's also, again, part of the reason why his entourage is so big, etc., is to kind of demonstrate to people that, you know, there is this new exciting, you know, flourishing empire of which, you know, you can be a part, you know, to which you can contribute. So he brings back from Mecca these poets and architects and mathematicians and philosophers on his way back, and he leaves, and actually when he gets to Timbuktu, and he actually leaves in Timbuktu some of them when he returns to his capital.
And there's this mosque, the
Djingareber Mosque.
And it's still, you can still go visit it today, can't
yes,
you?
Yes, yeah, yeah. You and... can, although it is quite dangerous though because of the Islamic fundamentalist groups. I wonder how I think that one is one of the less dangerous ones, but it's still that part of Mali. Timbuktu in general, you actually need an armed guard to travel through today. So,
well, thank God it's still there.
I was
really interested to know a bit about what it would have meant to the people of Timbuktu to have a structure like that put up. You know, was it comparable to anything else that was already in the landscape, or did it really stick out?
Obviously, not only had Mansa Musa built mosques in during his travels, but yeah, I think actually the architect, a poet architect called Al-Sahili, who's one of the people that Mansa Musa brings back with him from Mecca, is sometimes credited with introducing this kind of mud brick earthen, you know, architecture, that kind of style to Africa, and also the Sudanese mosque style. So things like flat roofs, you know, the minarets for Mali, and again, sort of helps Mali give this impression of somewhere which is, you know, worldly and, you know, different and exciting, etc.
Could you tell us a bit more about the university that was established there? Because I found this so interesting, because one of the things that I studied at university in my final year was 12th century European intellectual history. So that's all about universities, and everybody knows about Oxford and Paris and Bologna, but I don't feel like many people know about the university at Timbuktu, and I feel like it's maybe suffered from a very Eurocentric history of universities.
Yes. And it's interesting that, you know, the university in a lot of ways functions like a contemporary university. I mean, and it's centered around these three mosques. So the Djingareber Mosque, which is built by Al-Sahili, the Sankore Mosque, which I think is one that actually already exists, and the Masjid Sidi Yahya Mosque. And, you know, these three mosques form the center. And then there are all these other smaller schools, you know, madrasas, these Muslim schools. And at its height, I think it's estimated to have, you know, over 100,000 students.
Wow.
But, you know, you have, you know, in the earlier days, you have, 25,000 students and scholars. They're mainly coming from North Africa and the Middle East, and they come to study, you know, Islamic law, theology, a range of secular subjects. I mean, this university is able to attract people because of, you know, it's Islam and it's the study of Islamic teachings, which draws a lot of people to this university. The scholars at this university, especially in the early stages, are hungry for knowledge, and they're hungry for books in particular. So they're stories of strangers. When strangers come, you know, they're sort of given, you know, the royal treatment, as it were, because it's hoped that, you know, either the students, if these strangers come to Timbuktu, the students are really, really eager either to copy down, you know, some of what they've seen, so they want them to narrate, you know, certain stories so that they can write it down, or they're hoping that, you know, these strangers and travelers will donate books to the university. And at its height, again, I mean, the university is said to have, you know, over, you know, a million books and, you know, studies on the Quran and, you know, Arabic language as well. And actually both Arabic and West African languages, you know, are mandatory features of the curriculum. History, geography, astronomy, physics, poetry as well, which is interesting. Lots of libraries popping up, both, you know, in Timbuktu, both private and public libraries, but sharing libraries and sharing books is felt to be prestigious, and the free access to books was, you know, and a social obligation, and they're actually supporting education, which is very interesting, supporting education in, you know, among these three sites, in, you know, the mosques, is another status symbol. So what you have are wealthy patrons of the Malian Empire who are donating, similar to how, you know, donate to universities today, and this is a big feature as well in a lot of the US universities, but they're donating a lot of money to fund libraries and scholarships and, you know, school supplies, etc. And apparently another interesting sort of piece of trivia is that the way we have that practice today where the graduates throw, you know, the mortar boards in the air. I mean, they have this more in the US, you know, as part of the celebration.
Yeah.
This is something that apparently actually originated in Timbuktu.
Oh,
in the
really?
University of Timbuktu, yeah, where the medieval alumni would throw their turbans in the air as they received their diplomas. And I think actually once you graduated, similar to how, you know, you get like the I know some universities, like, you know, I think you get like, you know, the gown, like a different gown.
Yeah.
You get like a different turban once you graduated, which showed that you were a scholar.
I just love how all of these things kind of snowball, like the religion and the money and the architecture and the literary life and the scholarship, and all of they're kind of all feeding into one another and
exactly,
you know, growing and growing to become something so rich and so, yeah, so like amazing.
No, definitely. And I think that that's also a testament again to Mansa Musa. You know, he tries to see the big picture. You know, he sees the connections between, you know, religion, you know, law, scholarship, etc., all of which are required in order to build, you know, truly significant and a truly flourishing empire, flourishing kingdom.
It's such a wonderful story. I think just before we have to very sadly come all the way back to the present, a rather dreary day in London, you're allowed to bring one memento with you to the present from 1325. Right. And what memento would you like to bring back?
Yes, I've thought long and hard about this. I mean, there's so many nice treasures. In these times of uncertainty, it would be nice perhaps to bring, you know, a golden scepter. But being the being the romantic that I am, I would have to bring actually a book of poetry from the University of Timbuktu, because I think the Arab Persian as well, but Arab poetry definitely is some of the most beautiful in the world. So I'd bring back my book of Arabic poetry, have it translated, and it would remain a treasure for many years.
Is there any that survives today that we could look up?
Any treasures that perhaps are, I mean, a lot of the poetry, and this was devotional at this time, was devotional poetry. So usually when someone, you know, if someone died, a scholar, something like that, then, you know, you'd have, you know, some of his, you know, either some of his students maybe, or some of his colleagues, you know, who would write verse about, you know, about him and about his, you know, about his life and, you know, all the things he'd achieved and, you know, what kind of person he was, all interesting. And also you have Sufism as well. So, I mean, I don't know of any specific examples of that, but I know that if any fans of Rumi would definitely be fans of the poetry that was being written in Timbuktu at this time.
Cool.
No,
it sounds great.
Definitely.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on Travels Through Time today, Luke. That was it was an epic journey. I feel
I had a great time. I hope I was able to provide good information about all the scenes that, you know,
definitely,
which travelers, you know, visited together. So
great, thank you.
I had a great time. Thank you.
That was Artemis talking to Luke Papera about Mansa Musa and describing in fabulous detail one of the great moments of the Middle Ages. I love the picture of the university student throwing their turbans up into the air in celebration. It's always a magical moment, and it's nice to know that it's been going on for quite so long. If you haven't already noticed, we've published two time travels today to start off our third season. The other is with the brilliant scholar James Shapiro, who takes us back with a Shakespearean eye into the American mind. Please do check that one out. And remember, there's a whole catalogue of episodes available on our website, tttpodcast.com. We're on Twitter as well. If you want to follow us there, it's at tttpodcast_. We'll be back with another time travel next week. Till then, thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.